Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, today Let's Talk is being broadcast out of Port Douglas. Yes, way up north, beautiful part of the world. And we're at this massive big conference facility here. What's it called? The Mirage. Yeah, it's a beautiful place to be. So, the annual National Native Title Conference happens every year. Last year, you'll recall, you heard us broadcasting out of Coffs Harbour. And to talk to us about the conference, and my first guest is the principal of the Australian Institute of Aboriginal... IATSIS, Australian Institute of Aboriginal Studies. Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Studies. Russ Taylor is joining me. Russ, welcome to the program. It's good to have you here.
Thanks very much, Tiger. It's a pleasure to be on your program and to have an opportunity to talk to your audience.
Tell us your mob, your country.
Yeah, I'm a proudly Kamilaroi man from northwestern New South Wales, although I was raised and born and bred in Sydney.
How long have you been at the head of IATSIS?
This is my second time as principal or CEO, Tiger. This time I think it's about 6 years. And I've been there since 2009.
Mm-hmm. And you were recently awarded an AM. We've got to put AM. When we write Russ Taylor, we've got to put AM down behind the name now. Congratulations on that one.
Thanks very much, Tiger. It's nice to get recognition. I've got to say I feel very honoured and very humble to have my contribution recognised. And in saying that, I just have to say that I think it's recognition of the strong support I get from my family, as well as from the IATSIS Council, as well as others, with whom I interact and the various organisations that I'm involved with. So, but thank you very much for acknowledging that, Tiger. It's much, much appreciated.
What's the role? The role of IATSIS has been around for quite a number of years, and there was some threat to funding discussions about it anyway. You know, it didn't look real good there. It was about a year ago or so. What's the role, and how secure is government funding?
Tiger, the role for the last 50 years, and hopefully for the next 50 years and beyond, is, I guess, a dual role. One is to undertake research that is of value to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, a diverse research agenda, and we hope to continue that. And the second thing is really has to do with the valuable and wonderful archives, our collections that we have at IATSIS. That is, a huge, internationally significant collection of films, photographs, documents, audio tapes collected for the last 50 years or more that really tell the story and give significance and do true justice to the value and diversity of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures and histories and place in Australian society.
So what's the purpose beyond that? I mean, is it accessible by the public? Can you... What is the service to the public itself? How can we access it, black fella or white fella?
Yeah, you can... Well, the purpose really, Tiger, I guess, is to promote greater understanding, not just in Australia, but internationally, as I said, about the richness, the significance and the diversity of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander culture. You know, our songs, our languages, our customs, our kinship systems, everything that says something about the longest surviving group of people on the planet. And so that's our main mission. We do other things, including we publish books. We help people connect up through our family history. As I said, we do research. And particularly the reason we're here today is we provide a fairly significant support to the native title sector, and particularly Aboriginal groups that are seeking to have their native title determined successfully. So, that role for IATSIS will continue. In terms of the funding, you're right, mate, there was definitely a threat, and still is to some extent. However, we're in the education portfolio. We're not in the Indigenous Affairs portfolio. So, thankfully, through the support of our Minister, Christopher Pyne, a very strong support, we were able to get an increase in our budget this year. Unlike many, I've got to tell you, we understand the pain and trauma that made. But in IATSA's case, we got an extra $5 million. And essentially, that money is to continue our work to preserve, protect and digitise our collections that I spoke about earlier. And we'll continue that work. It's not the end of the story, Tiger. There's no doubt that we need more resources, more recognition. But at least at the moment, we have some breathing space in terms of the funding needs that we need to do the job properly.
The services you provide for Native Title, be a bit specific on that for us. Tell us what exactly.
It's Tiger. The service really to sort of summarise is mainly informational services. We provide information to the sector and particularly to Indigenous players in the sector by way of either representative bodies or prescribed bodies corporate. And as you know, prescribed bodies corporate is the organisation that actually holds the native title rights, and they're created as a provision under the Native Title Act. Unfortunately, they are charged with onerous responsibilities, and in most cases, they simply do not have the resources that match their responsibilities and expectations of their groups and their mob. So the IATSA's support in the Native Title is all about trying to capacity build the Indigenous component of the Native Title sector to the point where they can be equal players and in a position to negotiate effective outcomes that flow from their Native Title rights. We provide information about developments in the courts. We provide information about agreement making, provide information about dispute resolution and that sort of thing. We provide a lot of information about effective governance mechanisms, and we provide project-related support and activity that, as I say, essentially helps capacity build the sector so that they can get the best and maximum outcomes from any benefits that might flow from native title. So in a nutshell, that's what we do. We're a supportive mechanism for the sector.
You just mentioned that IATSIS comes under the portfolio of education now. When did that happen?
Oh, it's been on and off for the last few years, Tiger, where we were previously in the research portfolio, industry and research portfolio under the Labor government. Previously, we'd been in Indigenous Affairs, in communications, in the cultural sector. The latest development, as a result of the Abbott government coming to power, we were initially put in the Indigenous Affairs under Senator Scullion, in his portfolio, and then a few months later, in December of that year, we were transferred, I say, back to the higher education sector under Minister Christopher Pyne. And as I say, I have to say that one of the benefits of that is, unlike many of our, other organisations, Indigenous organisations, one of the benefits of those is that we're able to get some funding support, and I've already mentioned that. So it's been pretty beneficial for us to be in that portfolio. Although, as you know yourself, we're officially in that ministerial portfolio, we certainly operate in the Indigenous Affairs portfolio in various things that we do.
Francis. Okay. How you going? Huh?
I'll get you here
next later on. Yes, well, people walking around here, they want to say good day and stuff, you know. It's pretty deadly being here. It's a beautiful part of the world. And my guest at the moment is Russ Taylor, AM. As of the Queen's Birthday Honours List just a week or two back. Today there's an opening ceremony, smoking and stuff. Tell us about that.
Well, Tiger, every year for the last 20-odd years when we've hosted the Native Title Conference, we always host with a local-based organisation. In this case, the reason we're in Port Douglas is we're partnering with the Cape York Land Council, and we're really pleased with the support that we've got from Richie Armat and his team. Can also acknowledge the support and strong support of the North Queensland Land Council. Errol Neal and his board have been very supportive, as well as the Carpentaria Land Council. And this morning's ceremony, as you'd expect, is simply a recognition of the fact that we're in, you know, the Kuku Yalanji country. And like you, I'd like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the traditional owners and pay tribute to their resilience and their continued cultural survival and practice on country. So today's performance smoking ceremony is simply an appropriate cultural recognition that we are visitors in country, recognising and respecting country, and hopefully also, Tiger, giving some enjoyment and cultural enjoyment of the people that come from all over the country. This, you know, we have 700 delegates at this.
I was going to ask you how many, because it's one of the biggest conferences that takes place on an annual event here.
It certainly is, and I'm very proud of the AATSIS team in terms of how, you know, they, you know, organise and manage and facilitate this. But it is a wonderful conference. It's the biggest of its type in the calendar in Australia, no doubt about that. As you know, Tiger, a lot of Indigenous people draw a lot of value out of the networking and opportunities. I mean, we've got this conference this time, similar to previous years, over 150 speakers, most of whom are Indigenous, 70-odd different papers. I think the performances that we've organised with the conference, I think, involve over 45 performers from the cultural local cultural groups. So we're pretty proud of that, mate. And we're very proud to say that you know, we're partners every year in this activity. We're very proud of our record in that area.
And I must add, we've got the National Indigenous Radio Service news team here, the National Indigenous News Service, as last year in Coffs Harbour. So we've got, the broadcasting happening across our national network, our national First Nations media network, and Let's Talk broadcasts out today and tomorrow out of the National Native Title Conference at Port Douglas. What's some of the highlights for you, some of the things that you would say to people here not to miss during the conference, presentations, discussions, panel discussions?
I guess, Tiger, you know, it depends where you are in your native title journey. If you're trying to get your native title rights determined or you already have them determined, there are various sessions and papers being delivered and workshops that will be of considerable value. And look, there's a lot of challenges in working in the native title space. Many of our groups, some of whom have had their native title determinations made 20 years ago, some of them as only as late as, you know, the last few weeks have had their... So we're all on a different stage in that journey. This conference is about trying to get everybody together to learn from those experiences, to learn from the successes, to learn about the pitfalls. So the whole conference is of interest. Obviously, a couple of standouts is the Mabo lecture tomorrow by the Social Justice Commissioner, Mick Gooder, and also on Thursday we've got Noel Pearson coming along and giving a keynote. So they're probably the two standouts, but there are many standouts in a very diverse program over 3 days, Tiger.
With your involvement with Native Title, Russ, what are your... Have you seen some changes, some improvements? Because there was a review that took place. How do you see, looking back from when you first started, watching developments... Because there was some issues about, you know, the onus of responsibility for proof and the hoops to jump through and stuff. How do you see things, improvements along the way?
Well, Tiger, I still think the onus of proof is still fairly steep. And, you know, I think that's something we really do need to continue to talk about in terms of trying to, you know, make it a bit easier and a bit less stressful for our Aboriginal brothers and sisters to have their, you know, their native title rights determined. But I think there's a lot of improvements in terms of the ability of native title holders to negotiate sustainable outcomes, not just for themselves, but for their children and their children's children. And one of the benefits that I think is happening, and I'm proud to say that this conference has made a small contribution to that, is that more and more the benefits that flow from native title rights, and even, you know, in the early stages before determination, are enabling a lot of our mob to take advantage of the sustainable benefits that can be achieved through effective negotiations and effective agreement making. And I think in the early days, the agreements that we've seen made then, we could certainly say they needed to be improved. And I think we're seeing that. Over time, we're seeing more and more effective, beneficial agreements being made that are being made with the long term in mind. There's sustainable benefits, and I think that's great.
The economic base is important, Russ. We appear to be, to continue to be, land-rich, cash-poor. And it's great that native title determinations are recognised and things, but to come along with that, there's got to be access to that for economic development and sustainability in the long term. What are your thoughts?
I absolutely strongly agree, Tiger. I think, and, you know, we need to get away from this deficit talk. We need to make sure that everybody is aware that, generally speaking, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people want a better future for their kids. That means they're not anti-development. You know, we are for development, provided that development occurs on our terms and in ways that we want it to happen that aren't harmful either to our kids or our environment or our culture. And so I agree with you. I think there's a lot of work to be done in terms of harnessing economic opportunities in the longer term for our people. And in fact, Tiger, there's some very interesting sessions at the conference this week that go to trying to maximise economic development opportunities. And a native title, of course, offers a wonderful opportunity for people to do that. Not everybody, but for some. And I agree with you. I mean, look, there's no doubt, I think, along with education, you know, economic development and economic success is the future for our kids and their children. And so, once again, if this conference can make a contribution to the thinking and the approaches of individual groups and, you know, capacity build them to develop those things in a better way or, you know, in a way that is effective and sustainable, well, that's a good thing to do. But I do agree with you, mate, that that's the secret and that's the future of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. As I say, both education, I think that's part of the pathway, but the other one is to be proper, equal players in the economy of this country.
We just saw the anniversary of the native title legislation only a fortnight ago, I think it might have been, a week, 10 days ago. And it's good to see that there is continued effort and work being done by our mob out there. How do you think old Koike would be feeling, looking down on things and looking at the situation? Eddie Mabo, what do you think?
I think he'd have a couple of thoughts, Tiger. I think he'd be pleased with many of the developments, but I also think that he'd have some concerns about the issue we talked about before, about the onus of proof and, you know, the sometimes very elongated processes that people have to go through, sometimes extremely traumatic. So I think he'd be a little bit uncomfortable about that. But overall, I think he'd be pleased with that he's the fight that he fought has provided a wonderful platform for that. Can I just say, Tiger, as you're aware, that usually we hold the Native Title Conference on the anniversary, on Mabo Day. This time we changed it a little bit just to make sure, in discussions with our partners, the Cape York Land Council and others, to make sure that it fed into the Lora Festival to enable some of our delegates, you know, to attend and to enjoy that festival. Gail Mabo herself is here to represent the Mabo family. Tomorrow morning, Mick Gooder will be delivering the Mabo Lecture, which is an annual tribute to the work of Eddie Koike Mabo. And we know we're very proud and pleased to be able to do that, to remind people of the work and the struggle and the success that he had in getting his rights determined. And, you know, we're happy to continue that as part of our tradition.
Well, Russ, anything you want to say in winding up?
Only, Tigers, it's great to catch up with you and to see you. We go back about 30 years. I reminded you earlier when you were my chairperson at the Sydney Metropolitan Land Council, when we used to do battle in those days, and you went on to bigger and better things in the State Land Council. But I really treasured those times, and it's great to be able to catch up with you. I'm honoured, actually, to be able to catch up with you. I've always admired your advocacy and, you know, your fight, if you like, for our, you know, a better future for our mob. I thank you for that, and I also thank you for the opportunity to talk to your listeners. Much appreciated.
Good on you, Russ. Thank you very much for your time, mate.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Russ Taylor. I don't know who that fellow was he was talking about at the end there. You reckon it was me? I don't know. But this conference is being broadcast from From Port Douglas. We're out doing outside broadcast. The National News Service, it's coming from Port Douglas as well. And it's a beautiful part of the world. And there's some, I think, did he say some 700 or so guests, registrants for this conference. So it's one of the biggest meetings and gatherings in the country. Happens on a national, it happens on annually. And it's really good to see the different people that that come and go. I mean, Gail Marbo, I expect, daughter of Eddie Marbo, she'll be a guest here later this morning. And there'll be a number of others during the course of this broadcast. I think we're even going to look at broadcasting beyond 10 o'clock today. All going well. So we'll take a break for the 10 o'clock news and then come back and have some more guests join us. So make sure you stay around for the broadcast. Let's talk on your local First Nation station. Now, we are in Kookaburra country, and you see some deadly dances and songs and stuff by the many different performers and people of Kookaburra country. My guest now is Shay Spearing. Shay joined me a couple of months ago, live in the studio down in Brisbane. And he's the Indigenous Youth Representative for the United Nations. Shay, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Tiger. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you back in again. And you've been a bit busy, but before we get to talking about busy, tell us your mob, your country.
Yeah, so I'm Gungaloo. So most of the mob is still up in Woorabinda, Rockhampton area, central Queensland there. Yeah.
Did you grow up there on country? Where'd you grow up?
So I spent the first few years of my life growing up in Rockhampton. So I was born there, as were my mother and father. And then we moved around a fair bit when I was younger, though. We, Mum and I, we moved up and down the coast of Queensland and then finally off to down the Sunshine Coast and then later on in life down to Brisbane. So, yeah, I moved to Brisbane when I was 18 and I'm still living there in Brizzy.
What... You're only a young fella. What is it you want to see happen for your mob? What do you see looking around you? Where do you see the work that needs to be done? What is it that sort of triggers some of your passion?
Yeah, that's a tricky one, isn't it? I think, you know, seeing my family back up in central Queensland and being able to go up and visit them is great, because I'm in a really privileged and fortunate position right now. You know, I'm able to travel the country and go overseas, and I've studied at university. But I see a lot of people who are perfectly capable of doing the things that I've done, but they don't necessarily know it themselves. And that really motivates me to keep doing what I'm doing, because even though sometimes things get hard and things get a bit tough, I realise that it's about sometimes not necessarily paving the way. The road might actually be already there. It might already be perfectly paved, but there's no light shining on it, that's for sure. And so for me, it's about making sure that other people understand the opportunities that are available to them, because I think we're quite fortunate in this day and age, and there certainly are opportunities. Still have to work very hard for them, but sometimes it's just a matter of shining the light.
Yes, now you're right. Sometimes that road may well be paved, but there needs to be a light shone on it. What are some of the areas, some of the different elements of our struggle, of our survival, of our challenges and stuff? What are some of the ones that need the light shine on them?
I think, for me, when it comes to something as important as education, I personally didn't realise the significance it has on one's life and the ability, or the way it empowers you. And that's something I see a lot in young people around the country more broadly, but very specifically within Indigenous Australia. And I think if a lot of people could understand the application that a really good education can allow them to have on whatever it is that they go and, you know, want to apply it to in life, then they may be more willing to participate. But I think that's not necessarily their fault either. I think the applicability of a good, solid education isn't always communicated very effectively. And I think that's an issue in itself. I think it's about making sure that we're teaching young people out there things that they need to know, things that are very relevant to them, and at the same time making sure they're aware of the importance of anything else that may be presented to them in the future and they may have the opportunity to learn about.
So education is important, like white man education is important, but cultural education, identity, that education is going to be balanced up by that one.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what I was hinting at when I was saying we have to make sure that we're teaching people things that, you know, are applicable to their everyday lives. It's not as simple as saying this is what you need to know. It's about asking someone, no, you tell us what you need to know and then we'll help you learn it, you know, and if we can, we'll teach you or we'll find someone who can, you know. We'll support the necessary processes, programs, initiatives, what have you, that are out there that will be able to deliver this appropriate training and empower you to be the sort of person that you need to be for the community that you come from. So it's about making sure that we're consulting and we're collaborating before we actually even consider delivering, you know, education. So you're right, education can take many different forms. And I think it's really important that we understand that, you know, there's certainly not one shoe that fits, or one size that fits all. I certainly see that when I travel around the country. It doesn't matter what background you come from, you know, what your ethnicity, what religion, what colour your skin, people struggle. People struggle in the education system. And, you know, just coming back from the Northern Territory only a couple of weeks ago, seeing kids in grade 7, grade 8, and with the literacy, numeracy skills of, you know, grade 2 or 3. And it's absolutely heartbreaking stuff. And do I blame them? No, not at all. Not at all. There's a problem there, and it's a systemic issue, and we need to look really closely at ourselves as a society and say, if these are the sorts of people we're producing, people who can't engage and can't become one with the society, even if they so choose, then that's an issue.
The development of our social, the community, and socially, over the last 40 years, 40 plus years, we've seen self-determination implemented with the establishment of community-controlled organisations. Organisations established to service First Nations people, run by First Nations people, purely to, I suppose, fill the gap where our mob falls through the cracks. Mainstream services aren't catering to our needs. But along the way, we haven't seen education, like we've seen media develop since the early 80s I've been involved. That was one of the later developments. Early on it was childcare, housing co-ops, legal service, health services. But education, setting up our own schools, that's got to be, I don't know why, but that's got to be as important as anything else, surely. Because, as you've said, you've acknowledged there are problems within the education system. We are seeing our young ones in the education system way below their levels. But I don't see a lot of toy, or a lot of talk, or a lot of mobilisation around, let's take this thing in our own hands and teach our children. Let's set up our own community-based learning centres. What are your thoughts on that? Is there room for that? I mean, we've got to have choice. We must have choice. And independent learning facilities in our own community, under our own control, provides that choice. But have you seen any independent community-controlled schools in your travels? And how important is it?
Yeah. Well, see, firstly, very important, I think. I can reflect on my own personal experience there, but before I do that, seeing the Murray School that we do have in Brisbane and seeing how they tailor not necessarily just the system but the culture of the school to suit the needs of the students, I think is really appropriate for a lot of the kids there, because they're creating an environment where the children are willing to come and learn, but at the same time they feel safe and secure and they're given responsibility, and they certainly very much have, they're very certainly very much so have respect for some of the, for, you know, for the staff there, which I think is really important. I think there's quite a few experiences we can draw upon, not necessarily in Australia, but when it comes to delivering tailored education that's tailored to the people that it's being communicated to. I know that, you know, we have Montessori schools. I'm not aware of any necessarily in Australia, but I know over in New York and several other places in the United States where you'll have a community come together, develop a small space, and they'll have no more than 30 students and a teacher or maybe another staff member as well, and they will deliver the entire school day, and that's it. So it's about, you know, really local, really small scale, but at the same time creating that safe space, that culturally appropriate space for the people depending on their needs. Now, I think there's a lot we can look at. You know, it doesn't necessarily matter we're talking about sort of mainstream education or otherwise, but there are certain things that I think young people need to be taught a lot more, and everything from the issues that are more relevant today, so contemporary issues, which includes, you know, obviously substance abuse and drug abuse, what have you, but really basic things including sex education. There's a distinct lack of sex education in not just Indigenous communities, but mainstream Australia. And being in the Northern Territory recently, from my understanding, the public school curriculum, their sex education scheme ends at about grade 6.
That's when it should start.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that should be rolling along and building to something by that stage.
That's it. Exactly. So it's really interesting to then reflect upon, you know, what sort of outcomes are we getting from this? What sort of outcomes are being generated by this? And are they negative or are they positive? And, you know, what I'm seeing is that it's all negative. You know, we're having young people who don't know what to do with themselves, don't know how to understand their own bodies, don't know how to engage with other people. We see a lot of young people getting needlessly pregnant and not necessarily being empowered to take control of their own lives and look after the young people that they are then responsible for and things like this. There are some real issues out there, and I think it's a matter of consultation and collaboration and asking people what they need, and we can do that. You know, it's as simple as listening and not saying this is what you need, not being paternalistic or prescribing what they need.
Yeah, not having things imposed upon us, programs and things imposed upon us, is certainly an issue. With your travels through the territory recently, you visited Uluru for the first time.
Yeah, I did. That was, I'm not really sure if you can do it justice with words, but it's a deeply spiritual experience. It's the only way I can really describe it. You know, I certainly had no real idea. I couldn't really conceptualize the magnificence, you know, of that country there. Its beauty and its significance. And it was just an amazingly enlightening experience to go there and to be a part of it and to share it, because what's going on there today and what's gone on there thousands of years ago and what's, you know, is not necessarily indicative of what's going to happen in the future. But what we do know is that there's certainly going to be a very powerful, very strong, very spiritual future of that place. So it was really powerful to go there, because obviously we have significant pieces of architecture around the country, but I think very few people understand the magnificence of this particular place and its significance. And even though they may not necessarily partake in the significance and they may not necessarily align their spirituality with the needs or the understandings of the people that come from that country, they can still respect it and they can still enjoy it and appreciate it.
Did you visit communities, other communities? What was the purpose of your travel, and what was it like? What did you see?
Sure. So I originally started in Darwin, then we did a road trip down to Alice Springs and then back up from Alice, and obviously took the day off to go out to Uluru, which was fantastic, but then took another several days to travel back from Alice Springs up to Darwin again. Now, during the road trip, we visited schools and spoke with young people in Alice Springs, Tennant Creek and Catherine. And then when I was back up in Darwin, went and visited several schools and local organisations, including the Create Foundation, that deal with young people or work specifically in the youth sector. And while there, just talking to young people, finding out what's going on in their communities, finding out what issues they face in their communities, and then asking them what they think we should do about it, how they think young people or other people can work to address the issues. And that was really important, because then just before I left on the Thursday morning, but just before I left, I got to go and meet with the Minister for Youth, Peter Stiles. So it was really important that I travelled around the Northern Territory, spoke to the young people, not just identify the issues, but find out, you know, get that constructive feedback, find out what they think we need to do about it. And then I went and met with the Minister, which was good.
All right. Now, I was talking to Noel Pearson on the program. He was a guest on my program a couple of weeks ago. And he's saying, you know, Tiger, he said, there's people, the different inquiries and reviews and royal commissions and that, they can identify what some of the problems are. But they don't really identify or articulate what's the framework in which resolutions can be introduced and things. That's what are your thoughts on that?
I think that's really interesting because it's, you're right, it's perspective and framing is just so important. To give you an example, obviously travelling around and seeing drug and substance abuse, not just in the Northern Territory, but around the whole country, just in the general youth population, seeing that or having that identified to me is a big issue. Being in the Northern Territory, having sniffing identified as an issue, it's really interesting because then we actually look at the legal frameworks and how they actually address it. You know, obviously everyone accepts that, you know, drugs and drinking and their outcomes that are generated from them are issues that negatively impact on society and that we need to address. But then we actually look at the frameworks that do address them. And what we see is that they're always framed as criminal issues, and we see as people being punished or persecuted for engaging in those issues. But what we need to understand is that there may be something more to it. We need to understand why people go and seek out drugs and alcohol, why people may get into sniffing in the first place. What's the lack of opportunity they're presented with? Why do they feel the need to engage in this? Because maybe, ultimately, it's actually a health issue, not so much a criminal issue. So I very much agree with Noel when it comes down to framing and perspective, because if we're not generating the positive outcomes that we want to be generating now, given that we've been framing issues a certain way for however many decades, maybe it's time to rethink the way we frame these issues and then we can come up with new, more appropriate solutions.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got to be able to articulate and clearly identify just frameworks for dealing with issues, for working things through, because we all know the problems. We live with problems. We know what the solution is. But it's a matter of trying to clearly articulate that so people can see their way forward. That's a real issue. So where to now for you? You've got an overseas trip in a couple of months, I think September or so?
Yeah, that's right. So I'll be spending a bit of time travelling in the country furthermore until September, and then in September I'll be heading over to New York when we have the 70th session of the UN General Assembly sitting, and I should be spending up to about 2 months over there and giving a presentation to the UN General Assembly's third committee, identifying all the issues that young people in our country are facing and also how they think we can actually solve these issues. And then coming together with five international counterparts as well. So we have youth delegates from all around the world, and I'll be sitting in some OECD council meetings, and we'll be discussing some of the broader international frameworks and whether or not they're appropriate and what we can actually do about it, how we can help young people. So, yeah.
All right. It's important that we have that engagement and representation in the international arenas and things. I suppose that's also what drives you too. The importance of being able to represent, being able to present the issues, the feelings, the aspirations of our mob and letting the world know about it and our achievements. I mean, celebrating success and achievements.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's it. It's about making, you know, there's nothing, I suppose I can't really put into words like the sense of honour, but also the great responsibility of representing people on the international stage. There's nothing like it. But you know what, Tiger? There's also the responsibility we have to just represent on the everyday level. And that's something I always advocate for as well, because people say to me, you know, yeah, sure, you have the opportunity to go and speak at this conference, go and talk to these people. And I always say to everyone, but for me, it's not just about, you know, I got here somehow, basically. And I got here because I believe in this. But I got here also because it's about living a life that people should want to emulate, and one that creates the societies that we want to live in, a life of respect for the lived experience of other people, and a life that doesn't necessarily infringe on the rights of others, one where we can actually live in harmony and create inclusive societies. And I think that's really important. So as good as it is to be able to represent at the international level, it's also really important to be able to represent just on the local level, just when you're walking down the street, when you're having a yarn with someone, just when you're meeting with family again and being yourself.
Yes, no, you're right there. Anything else you want to tell us in winding up?
No, I think that's all. Look, but
before you do go, yeah. You're on a panel here. You've got a presentation. Yeah. You're involved in the discussion here.
I am. So, at the Native Title Conference, I'm actually part of the youth streams. So IATSIS have flown me up here. So a big thank you to IATSIS for bringing me up here to be a part of the program. And I'll be giving a presentation as part of the youth stream on international frameworks for Indigenous people and how young Indigenous people around the country can look at using or utilising these international frameworks and becoming a part of the international process, and how that can look at empowering us back at the local level again, you know, that top down. But obviously we have to look at bridging it, meeting in the middle sometimes. So as long as you're participating in the process at home, then you're going to find it quite easy to participate in the process internationally when it comes to Indigenous issues, and that's something I'm going to be speaking to today. So, yeah.
Mate, that's important that we have our people more, especially the young ones, but still the older ones as well, being able to, what was direction and support and assistance, but people must engage. People, we want change. We want empowerment. You know, we want the economic independence and economic development. But we've got to have people willing and committed to engage and to be involved and to make the effort.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Tiger. And I think one of the other messages I'm going to be carrying across really comes down to understanding what it means to be a member of this society and then how the international community perceives you. So understanding that if you're a citizen of Australia, what that means, what rights and entitlements you have at your feet, and then how you can actually utilise those to achieve what it is you want to achieve back here at home, but by going out in the international community and discussing some of the issues with the international community and getting them to assist you in your needs and addressing some of the problems or issues you may be facing back here at home. And that goes for everything, including issues such as native title.
Most certainly. I think one of the things that I want to emphasise there was two-way strong, the education, the cultural identity and that business, two-way strong, is important for our mob. If we want to really make changes, we've got to have young fellas coming through and our older people that are two-way strong.
Yeah, no, and I definitely agree. And I think then also what you've just put in my mind reminded me about is that I always say to people as well that education shouldn't necessarily stop at school. That's not how it works. You know, we need to make sure that we're supporting families so that they can then teach their young ones and they can then go on to inform strong communities, because as far as I'm concerned, you know, it takes a lot to raise a child, to make a good, to deliver everything that a child needs. And if we can create a community that creates, in turn, a supportive environment to raise healthy, happy kids that are then empowered to go out and make the change that needs to be made in their communities, you know, to making sure that we're staying up to date with everything, we're meeting the needs of the changing world around us, it really comes down to how are we going to deliver education outside of school, and understanding that maybe if school isn't enough, that's fine, but then we need more. And we need to make sure we're supporting and creating the right communities to deliver the right outcomes.
Shay Spearing, the Indigenous Youth Representative of the United Nations, my guest. Thank you very much for your for spending some time with us today. Really appreciate it, man. And good luck with your future travels and endeavours. Thank you.
Thanks, Tiger. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks again for having me, and I'm sure I'd love to be on again sometime soon in the near future. So, yeah, thanks again.
We'll have you back anytime, man. Good on you. Thank you very much, Shay Spearing. Gungaloo man, Rockhampton way. He's on his way to the to New York in September for a UN forum over there. And, a fine example of a young First Nations man that's got his eyes open and ready to move. Now, we're broadcasting Let's Talk live from Port Douglas. Port Douglas is about an hour's drive north of Cairns, right on the coast, on the beach up here. It's a beautiful place. And we're at the National Native Title Conference. It's an annual event. Last year it was at Coffs Harbour. We were there broadcasting. And now we're here at Port Douglas, enjoying the beautiful warm weather up here. By gee, it's a nice change from Brisbane, where you've got to pull a big doona over top of you every night. Up here, you need a booming fan on, your air conditioner on or something. So it's great. A nice change. My next guest, Scott Gorringe. Scott, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thanks, Tiger. Yeah, I'm going pretty good, mate. You're just talking about coming from Brisbane. I just come from Canberra, and it's a little bit cool down that way.
Tell us your mob, your country.
Mythica, right out around Windora and Burswell Way. Those three big rivers that fill Lake Eyre, the Cooper, Diamantina and Georgina. I belong to two of them, the Cooper and the Diamantina, and it's pretty special country for us. And I think being here this week is going to be critical to, you know, trying to protect our rivers. I've just seen a few of the neighbours, the Buntamara mob and the Wankanguru mob, so we're going to try and get together today or tomorrow and have a little conversation about how we build an alliance to protect our rivers.
Good one. Those river systems are the lifeblood of our culture, really, aren't they?
Yeah, they're critical. You know, they're critical not only to us. If you ever look at our way, they're critical to the graziers and to the existing industries out that way. You know, and what the Queensland government, previous government is trying to do, and I think this one's attempting to do as well, is build economic development off the back of coal seam gas and shale gas operations. And, you know, that's going to be really dangerous to our rivers and our underground water system, the Great Artesian Basin. And, you know, we just want to be able to have a real say in trying to protect those and get at the table with the government around mapping a way forward with it.
Yeah. Scott, where'd you grow up?
I grew up around Windora. Went to school in Windora. Then I moved into the Big Smoke, into Quilpie. And then I was really fortunate to be part of the federal government's push to get education for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And I went to boarding school at Warwick and Slade School in Warwick. So grew up around Windora, Quilpie, and on a property in between Birdsville and Windora called Mount Leonard.
So after school, you spent a fair bit of time on country, on land?
Nearly every school holidays, we used to spend on country with Dad and Mum, either chasing dingoes for some pocket money or working on properties with Dad and my brothers and sisters. And I count myself as very, very fortunate because I had the opportunity to be on country with Dad and learn from him, Bill Gorringe, and also had the backing of Mum, Ivy Gorringe, to really push my formal education. So I would count myself really lucky that way.
Mm-hmm. Did your formal education stop at high school, or did you continue on after high school?
I finished year 12 at Slade. I think I'm now a member of my family to finish year 12. And then I'm the youngest, and then I went and got a job at Primac, and then I was old stocker station agent. And then from, you know, I started my university experiences when I was about 39 or 40. So I was a long time working before I got back into formal education. And
what triggered that?
I was breaking down. I was starting to get sore in the back and in the shoulders, and I decided that I had to do something a little bit more less physical. And I also had this yearning to contribute in a different way to the conversations that were going on around Indigenous. So I really...
So what did you study? What did you look at doing?
I was lucky enough to meet some really, really deadly people that supported me to do university at University of Queensland at the Gatton campus in Queensland. And I studied, ended up getting a Master's of Rural Systems Management. And so I did all my university externally. And within that time, I was fortunate enough to win a scholarship to go to Canada. So I spent about 6 months in Canada, 5 months in Canada, studying at University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And that was one of the most I'm trying to think of a big word. It's probably extraordinary experience that I've ever had, you know. So,
why was that? What was so different or good and valuable about being in Canada at the university there for 6 months?
I got the opportunity to stop and think and read and learn and have different conversations with people, and it really challenged the way that I thought about things, and it really challenged my approach to my life after that.
And you're in your 40s now. You're talking about a period of in your 40s, early 40s.
Yeah, I think I was...
Or mid-40s.
Yeah, probably about 44, 45 by then. Yeah. And it really shifted the way I thought about everything. And I'm very thankful for a few people. You know, one of my lecturers who I class as one of my mentors and heroes now, Graham Smith from New Zealand, he really shifted the way I thought about things. So that was the best experience I've ever had for learning.
So how are you putting those learned experiences with your master's studies and British Columbia over there in Vancouver? How are you applying that today or in the last 10, 15 years, 20 years?
I don't know if I'm allowed to promote, but I got my own business called Murray Matters, and we deliver, I don't know whether it's training, but it's processes across Australia. At the moment, we've been focused in education. There's some noise around.
A little bit there.
Yeah. And at the moment, we've been focusing on education, but we're starting to branch out into other industries now. And what we do is challenge the conversation that exists in and around Aboriginality, basically. And those same kind of conversation, you know, when I say challenge the conversation, the existing conversation that exists around Aboriginality is deficit. Everything's grounded in negativity, and all our policies, all our conversations, all our practices, all our behaviours are the things that are holding us back, and it's just the way that we're framing our approach and our conversations. I believe it's one of our greatest challenges, and so I'm using all those skills that I learnt way back then, and the stuff that I'm picking up now, the new learnings I'm picking up now, in my work with my business. I'm also part of a ARC, which is an Australian Research Council grant, with ANU, the National University in Canberra, and we've got a 3-year project now looking at the impact of deficit discourse on Indigenous education and on our children's education. And if we run a process such as Nguri, which is the one that I run in my business, which comes from Mithika people, if we run Nguri with a group of teachers and some parents in a school over a period of 2 to 3 years, what kind of impact does that have on the conversation? And then how does that start to shape behaviour, teaching and learning, and the outcomes of Aboriginal kids for education? So we're looking at that, you know. Anecdotally, we see it happening with the work that we're doing already. And I used to do a lot of work with the Stronger Smarter Institute, which was set up by Dr. Chris Sara, and we see it happening in that program and those processes. So we kind of know it works. We just want to now wrap some really nice research around it to get some really strong data around it so we can start to push this a little bit harder.
2 points I want to pick up on, and first things first, you mentioned news. We got 2 minutes to news. My producer's telling me here. She's shaking a big stick at me too, make sure I finish on time. But we're going to have to get you back after the news, because I want to continue, if you've got time, I want to continue on with the discussion. There's Aboriginality, because that's opening a Pandora's box, Aboriginality. I mean, there's what I call tick in the box, tick and flick. Are you Aboriginal? Yep. But there's no real evidence, there's no real lived experience for a lot of people who are just claiming to be, yes, I'm Aboriginal. That's causing some concerns or some issues and challenges, not only for those people that, through no fault of their own, are Aboriginal people, but they've never been brought up in that way and got that lived experience of being in the black community. That's something. We're about out of time here, so we're going to come back. Scott Gorringe, you do have time. Yes, we're back with Scott Gorringe straight after the news. Stay with us. So welcome back to Let's Talk. We're broadcasting out of the Native Title Conference being held at the Mirage Resort. There's a black fellas everywhere. It's a real black out here, eh? It's real deadly. Black fellas everywhere. It's the best. A good feeling. Some 700 people have registered for this conference from all walks of life, from all parts of the country, all communities. And my guest at the moment is Scott Gorringe, a Mitika man. You say Mitika man, eh? As I said, all right? Mitika? Yeah, all right. Scott, you, before the news, you touched on Aboriginality. You mentioned Aboriginality. Now, there's some real serious discussions required around Aboriginality, about identifying, about ticking the box. A lot of people don't realise if you're going to tick the box and claim Aboriginal identity or Torres Strait Islander identity, there's some responsibilities. There's an obligation to know about your mob. It's not good enough being able to, well, in a lot of cases, pass off as white, look white, being able to pass off as white. Now, there's no, I'm not, I don't want to criticise people. We can't help. I don't have a lot of colour myself. But there's this discussion needed about Aboriginality and what those obligations are, what those responsibilities are for us. What are your thoughts on this? Is it a conversation that's needed to be had, but very, very carefully and well structured and stuff? I mean, it could go haywire real quick and just destructive.
I think the conversation's already happening, Tiger, you know, and as you said there, it's fairly destructive at the moment in a lot of instances, because we've been told forever what it means for us to be Aboriginal by other people, you know, and it was firstly constructed by white fellas a long time ago, and that's continued, and now we're constructing it for ourselves, and it's still got the same taint of destruction in the conversations, in the same pattern. And this is one of the things that I'm trying to do with ANU is trying to shift the conversation, trying to change the conversation around Aboriginal people and Aboriginal issues. Currently, it's all grounded in deficit, and if we have the conversation without really trying to understand that, we're just going to create more turmoil for our young people and for our old people. You know, this thing about who I am and who I am as an Aboriginal man, I'm not real sure what it means for me. What I am sure of, what it means for me to be Mitika. I understand that, you know, because of the way that my family have talked with me and my family have brought me up as an Aboriginal.
That's important. That's important that we're tying ourselves, our identity, back to the country of our ancestors.
Yeah.
Your parents, your grandparents. That's important. I like the way you put that. Yeah. I'm not sure of where I stand as far as an Aboriginal man goes, because in that phrase, in that moment, we're talking white terms of reference. Yeah. But when you shift that and say, I know what it means to be a Mitika man, that's important. That we talk on our own terms of reference.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if you talk about our connections as Aboriginal people, it's fairly destructive, you know, and you're always wallowing around in the rubbish. And I think if we continue to do that, we're going to really struggle to try and shape our future. Me as a Mitika man, I'm okay with who I am as a Mitika man. I understand that. I'm more focused now on how I am instead of who I am. The how I am, and it took me a little while to get to this place, how I am with myself. So here's the thing. I think identity is important, but if we start to try and talk about that from the starting point as who I am, I think it sets up this separatism and creates a barrier between people. I'm more focused on how I am how I am with myself, how do I treat myself, how do I care about myself, how do I talk about myself and how I think about myself, and how I am with others, other people, how do I treat them, how do I work with them, how do I talk with them, how do I listen with them, and how I treat this country that I'm in.
So relationships.
Relationships are the key for me, and it takes away the stuff around who I am and focuses on how I am. Yeah, and I think if we can have conversations about how we are, and that's what, you know, the process I run calling Guri, that's all it's focused on. How are we together? And then can we be robust? Can we challenge each other and still walk out of here positive and focused and moving forward with something that's bloody hard to move forward with, you know? And can we do that? And if we can't, we have a real problem. And at the moment, we are pitting them against us. And we're doing it within ourselves. And, you know, we see it happening every day on media and in our communities and all that sort of stuff. And we just need to get back to the basics, I think, around understanding how we're supposed to be together.
Well, a good example of this, I don't know, turmoil, mind stuff, is constitutional recognition, pitting them against us. And it's a lot of that is us as blackfellas, us as First Nations people, with our different views. How do you see this constitutional reform? Is there a need for change, amendments? Take the race clauses out and what have you? It's hard to jump forward to referendum without knowing what the referendum questions are going to be. What are your thoughts?
Oh, that's a hard one to ask me, Tiger, because I'm not really up on it. I suppose there's a need to have this conversation, but I think, you know, I was tweeting with Megan Davis, and you know, I asked her the question because I don't really know what is the conversation that we need to have, and because at the moment we've got two different conversations that are trying to be had, and I think one's probably splitting the other conversation, and it's, you know, it's going to be really hard to get this thing through if it happens. But Megan was saying something around we need to be more holistic in our conversations about what we're talking about, and, you know, if you bring it then back to about how we want to talk about it. You know, at the moment, we've got Aboriginal people against Aboriginal people in this conversation, which makes it really difficult to move forward. So I don't know. But what I do know is if we can come to a place where we get all these really clever people like Megan Davis and Noel Pearson and those sort of people, and Mick Dodson, you know, in a room, to have these kind of conversations in a different way, not in the same way, in a different way, we might be able to come up with something pretty deadly, you know? I think...
For me, that's it.
Yeah, all right. Is it something that blackfellas can say, look, it's a white thing? This constitutional reform, constitutional amendments, is a white thing. Sure, we're not recognised... But so we haven't been recognised for a couple of hundred years, or 1901 when they introduced the business. We don't really need to be involved in this. Is that, and that's what's one of the arguments, well, some of the school of thought is out there, because it's initiated by government. It hasn't come from blackfellas, from the ground and stuff, you know. And it doesn't, my problem is it doesn't, I suppose, embrace or take into account self-determination and empowerment. It's just like a symbolic thing. And is that going, is that worth the effort and the time and the energy and the discussions that's required? It's a real dilemma for a lot of our mob.
Yeah, It is. Yeah, I kind of got nothing on that one, do I?
No, that's fine. That's fine. Schools, black schools. I spoke to my guest, just young Shay Spearing, about Aboriginal people, our mob. We haven't taken that step into where we're in control of the learning and the teaching of our children. Whereas we took the steps, and I see it as self-determination, with the establishment of legal services back in the 70s, the housing corporations, the health services, all of those things. That's self-determination. That's black communities taking steps and establishing services that are going to cater to our mob. But the school thing, we haven't done that. Media, we didn't do media until early 80s. Yeah. I mean, it's some 30, just over 30 years since I first got involved with media. But it's over 40 years since the health service and the legal service and all those have been established. So media was a little later on. Schools, we're still waiting. What are your thoughts? Is there a need? Is it important? Because when you look at the outcomes and trying to get our kids and our parents and our communities to engage with the schools, and you look at the outcomes where our kids are getting out of the schools, and you look at communities and what's to offer in communities insofar as work, there's no incentive or little incentive for our kids out in rural and remote areas to go to school, because there is lack of employment opportunities and a whole range of things. There's no real need to. You don't get a newspaper in a lot of places until a day or two later. So library services, things like that, there's no real need for English in some of these places. But then again, there is, because we've got to be two-way strong. What are your thoughts about education and being in control of our own facilities?
Well, they kind of did it in New Zealand, eh? You know, that in the 80s, I think they set up total immersion Maori language schools, and the success, I think, over there has been varied. You know, some of them have been really successful, and others have struggled. So the idea of having total Indigenous schools in Australia, I think, I think it'll be a fantastic idea for a lot of parents. And for a lot of kids, I think they'd really jump at those opportunities, and there'd be a way to engage children in learning. At the moment, there's a real focus on education and schooling, and there's been a shift away from learning. And I think where Aboriginal, and it's not only an Aboriginal thing, Tiger. I think this thing, a lot of parents are really struggling with it. We want our kids to be happy. We want our kids to be safe. We want them to be motivated, and to have dreams. And a lot of our schools are not providing that to every child. And if we can get all of our schools providing that to every child, man, it'd be a fantastic place to live in this Australia, you know, and the things that we could do. But at the moment, we're struggling to find those places. And we're really focused at the moment, you know, economic development and industries are driving our education systems. And I think that's one of our biggest challenges, is how do we regain what education's about? For me, education's about learning and you know, enabling students, enabling kids to be really strong contributors to our society, and you know, it's we don't only contribute by working, we don't only contribute by adding to the economy, you know, and at the moment that's all our governments are focused on, bloody economy. I'm a little bit different, I suppose, than a lot of people, and I really focus on relationships. How do we get those strong? I'm not a dill to think that, you know, economy is not worthwhile. I participate in it. I got my own business, all that sort of stuff. I'm not a bloody hypocrite, but it's not what drives me. The relationships are the things that drive me. If money comes along with it, well, that's fine. If it doesn't, I'm still okay. I've got good mates and good friends and good family. You know, so that's what drives me.
And that relationship thing, Scott, it's relationship with country and land, and you emphasised that early in the piece, and then it's relationship with people around you on that land, you know. So relationship
in a word can cover so much and mean so much. And that's important, those relationships, for sure. Brother, it's been good to talk to you. You got anything else you want to add before we wind up?
No, I think that's about him. I think let's just focus on how we are together, Tiger, you know, and we get that right. How I am with myself, how I am with this country, and how I am with other people, everything else falls into place. I think they're the key things for me, and that's how I want to live my life. Thanks, bud.
It's good to meet you. You've been on the program as a guest and stuff. It's good to meet up with you, put a face to the name and the voice. But and I'm looking forward to more discussions with you. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, that was Scott Gorringe, Mitika man. Out Windora way, they have them big rivers, Diamantina and what's some other ones he said? There's a couple of big rivers out that way. The lifeblood of country and culture and societies. So we're broadcasting Let's Talk live from the National Native Title Conference from the Mirage Resort at Port Douglas. There's some 600-700 people registered to attend this conference, and it's big. It's a proper blackout. Now my guest, first woman on the program, it's taken me an hour to find her. Well, it's taken me an hour to fill the space with a female, and there's got to be some gender balance here. Gail Mabo, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
It's good to have you here on the program. Tell us your mob, your country.
Well, my father's from Murray Island, so I'm Miriam, and my mother's from Ingamoy, so I'm two mob there. I'm actually Mambra from Palm Island. I'm descended from there, and I'm Nawagi from the Ingham area.
All right. Now, we've just seen the anniversary of the big day that your dad, Eddie Mabo, established, the legislation of the Nation, like the manifestation of his efforts was the legislation, the Mabo legislation. How does it feel all these years later for you as the daughter of Eddie Mabo to see the recognition of the work of your father and to see around country where people are being recognised, I suppose. There are native title determinations that's recognising people as traditional owners. How does it feel for you as a woman of the 21st century, looking back over the years, your father's efforts and the work that's continued on?
Well, I think it's fantastic because one of the biggest highlights of my dad's case is that it's given voice, the black voice, back to the black people, and they can stand on their own country and, you know, actually tell you who their mob are and where they come from proudly now. So to instill that back in black Australia, that's fantastic because there is a, you know, they were quiet for a while. You know, there were people moving and doing things, but the voice was going, but Dad brought the voice back again. And so with that, moving forward as a people is good, but it's now time for many other changes and many other recognitions and you know, standing up to governments and saying, you know, no, this is ours.
What are your memories of those times when your father, there would have been conflicting views with what he was doing with his own mob and our mob generally, and there would have been a lot of support? What are some of the memories for you of those times? There would have been some turbulent times and stuff. What are some of the memories for you?
There were some. I remember nights when he'd come home and he'd been, you know, he had a couple of drinks, and he'd get really, really, you know, angry. And you know, and Mum was the only one who was there. You know, he'd take sometimes, you know, be aggressive towards her, but you know, he had us to deal with too because we weren't going to let him get away with it. But we needed him to sort of just calm down and just calmly talk about what it is. But, yeah, the things that really frustrated him were that people weren't listening to actually what he wanted because they all tainted him as a crazy man. And so as a visionary, you know, people believe that you are crazy because your thinking isn't like what normal people think. And because Dad had a vision for moving his people and, you know, all of Australia forward, you know, and that you have to be, you know, slightly insane, but be focused and, like, you know, be driven to be focused about what you want to achieve. And, yeah, he did. He fought a lot of people. He knuckled up. He, you know, people had arguments with him. They'd go out, they'd step outside of a party and they'd be outside and having a dust up in the car park. And he'd go, like, you know, it's like, Dad, you're passionate, but oh, my God.
That's taking passion a bit too far, you think?
Oh, but, you know, he was firing, you know, whoever was around him just had to watch out.
Yeah.
But he was one of those people that were like, nope, this is what I'm going to do and this is the right thing to do.
What do you do to honour the achievements of your father and in your own right, your contribution? What is it that keeps you busy?
It keeps me busy. Well, I speak at a lot of conferences. I speak at a lot of for different organisations everywhere. I speak in schools. I speak. Well, whoever wants to hear me, I'll come and speak. So, but it's that thing of like speaking about him and keeping his, because to me, he's not dead. His life will always go on, and his achievements will always be, you know, something that we, as Indigenous people, have to, you know, look at, because, you know, it's like the achievements of, you know, Nelson Mandela and, you know, Martin Luther King. We have to, you know, look to those people who were those leaders, you know, and Dad was one of those. Even though, you know, people didn't believe, you know, this man at the time, but he stuck to his guns, you know, and he pulled his family closer, and he told us everything he was doing, you know. I remember him coming to me and crying because, you know, he's saying, you know, the government's, you know, trying to do things and not support him in any way. So with that, it was one of the things is, how do you console your father when he's crying? Do you give him a hug? Do you sit next to him? Do you give him a cup of tea? Or you just let him sit there and do it? But that's where, you know, for me, my dad, I honour his legacy by being his daughter and talking about him, because, you know what, I want to keep him alive as long as I can.
Well, you know, it's like like you say, it's not as if he's gone anywhere. The presence, the now, that's that energy and everything is still here. It's amazing, really, when you think about it, when you put it in those words. It's amazing. It's fantastic.
And also, too, I mean, we were honoured this year on the 3rd of June by the Sydney Observatory actually giving my father a star in the constellation. So you know what? That means, you know, he's still there. He's watching over everybody. And guess what? That to me is the most powerful thing that can happen.
They did that for my mother, Maureen Watson, about 6, 7, 8 years ago. Same thing. She got some star somewhere up there. But it was in the name of that honourable ancestor, because she embraced and promoted that concept of being honourable ancestors. And that was the way they recognised my mother. Yeah, no, it's a good thing. A good thing to know they're up there. They watch them still. Yeah, yeah. What are some of your concerns for today? Looking around, young people, education, constitutional recognition, these sorts of things. What are your thoughts?
Well, with kids, we have to make sure we maintain a good relationship with them and empowering the strength of who they are, because a lot of suicides are happening. Is it because of they have no one to speak to, or is it because they're not strong within themselves as cultural people and they think their voice doesn't matter? Everybody's voice matters. So we have to embrace and support them. And, you know, with constitutional recognition, you know, to me, it's open for discussion, because, you know, I have questions I want answered, and I want to know, you know, as when it does step in, how does that really affect us? Do we become just like the rest, or can we still stand alone and have our own voice? You know, when my questions are answered, I might go, okay, I know what I want to do. Either go yes or a no. But like all things, it has to be open to discussion, and I think more in-depth discussions have to be given, because we can't just take it that, oh yes, that's a good thing. We all have to say yes. But what are the rights of Indigenous Australia? What rights do we have? We need to have those voices, you know, heard and, you know, going, well, hang on, I have concerns, because if it's going to take away our rights, does that abolish native title? Does that abolish all our rights, you know, to what we have now?
There's a lot of questions and there's a lot of conversation. Proper conversation needed, and I think that's one of the issues at the moment. We're not able to participate in proper conversation at community level. How do you feel about it?
Well, I think, you know, those who are doing the constitutional change need to go back into communities and consult with communities, because, you know what, it's the grassroots people who are going to change it, not those high flyers because, you know, you can have the faces that sell a product, but at the end of the day, you got to be convicted. And you know what? You have to convince the ground people. Because if people on the ground don't understand what they're voting for, you know, are you just coming in to bluff them and take it away from them? Because, you know, let's engage in conversation. Let's give them the information that they need. Let them make the choices.
Yes, no, I think you're right there too. Yeah. Any particular projects you're working on personally?
Well, one of the main projects that I'm working on, and which will hopefully be achieved by mid next year, is starting a foundation in honour of my father. So with that, it's a foundation that will be called the Eddie Mabo Foundation, and in that there will be a section that'll be, you know, honouring my mother and through scholarships. So yeah, so I'm still working on it, but it's one of those things that, you know, it will be achieved.
That's a work in progress, eh?
Very much so.
All right, Gail, look, thanks for joining us today and good luck with that that foundation. And certainly we must remember and honour our parents and our old people. Thank you very much, Gail Mabo. Thank you. Yeah, Gail Mabo, daughter of Eddie Mabo, talking to us. Have a seat, brother.
Yeah, good one, huh?
We're broadcasting Let's Talk out of the McCure. It's not even McCure, it's Mirage, I think. It's Mirage, yeah. I'm forgetting who I am. Forgetting where I am, actually, yes. Now, I've got Alfred Diamond, Cape York Land Council. Cooka Yalanji. All right. Tell us your mob, your country.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Is it all working now?
It's all working. Oh. You're on the radio, huh?
Wow, man. Hello. Name's Alfred Diamond. I represent Googie Yalanji people of Mossman from Mowbray River to the Annam, north of Mossman, nearly to Cooktown. And I hope all these people enjoy yourself while you listen on the radio. Welcome to Yalanji country, and we hope you all come and visit sometime. And
it's certainly a beautiful country up this way. How important is it for you for the native title discussion, this gathering of some 700 people are registered for this conference? How important is it for our mob to be sitting down talking about all the different issues, but particularly native title?
Yeah, well, I'd love to see us back on country and working our own country and living on it, because you know, otherwise, how are we going to spread back out around the area and have people all over and creating work for ourselves? And, well, we need everything, because the government doesn't seem to acknowledge us, and national parks and all that, they seem to do ILUAs and that, and then they don't come forward with what's written down on the ILUAs, which makes it pretty bad for our people. At the moment, we're working with Douglas Shire, Mareeba Shire on working on this rural building, a rural housing for our country, so that people can back on country and, you know, even Wybal to go back on where they live and build housing there where they can afford without restrictions on building of homes and that.
All right. So it's important then for our mob to be able to get back on the country, you think?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Yeah, we have to get back on country. How are we going to look after it? Huh? We can't do that from living in towns and that.
That's right.
If we're back on country looking after it, we can do our clearings and, you know, do. We've got timbers and all that on our country where we can do select clearing and that and sell and build houses and everything, so that our families are on country, not off country.
Do you see it? Are there opportunities for people to live off the grid, as they speak, you know? Meaning, I suppose, no electricity, no Shire Council bylaws and restrictions on what structure you're building and living. Because I think there's a lot of our mob that would like to be on country and build a suitable structure for themselves and their family, but not necessarily have all that electricity and all them bylaws with council and restrictions and stuff that way. Do you think there's opportunities for that with native title determinations for some of our mob? Or just in your own area, Cooka Yalanji country?
Oh, no, I'd love that to be all over Australia, you know, so that it's good for us. That, you know, if we need electricity, there's such a thing as solar power. And a lot of people forget about that, but it's very expensive for solar power, so, you know, that doesn't help us very much. We're not rich people, it's, you know, like my name, Diamond. It's a rich name, but I'm a poor black fella like everybody else.
Where did you grow up as a young fella?
It's Mona Mona Mission outside of Caranda, Gordon Vale, Ingham, Palm Island.
All around, yeah, all around. When you look back over your life, what changes, what improvements, how do you feel about change and things happening with our mob? Do you see us going forward? Do you see a few steps backwards? What do you see from a man that's been around for some time?
We get ahead. We, you know, one or two steps forward, and then we end up back, usually a 360 and back at square one again. The government only seem to want us to go so far, and then they stop us. I don't understand the reasoning why is that, because they talk about us being, you know, people of Australia. Well, why aren't they giving us the chance, the opportunities to do these things on our country and look after it and run it ourselves?
But what are some of those opportunities on country, you think? Like looking at your own country and native title. What are some of the opportunities? There's tourism, I suppose, ecotourism, things like that, jobs. I mean, what is there? Economic development?
Yeah, well, there's, you know, like you said, there's tourism and that, but there's also the ocean out there that we could use with our license for our own boats and that, and fishing, and there's timber on our country that we could use to sell. We do select clearing like they do, because I've worked for forestry department and worked for the DPI as a nursery tent and horticulture and that, and operated machineries and worked fencing and all sorts of stuff, fishing, diving, and, you know, there's all opportunities there for us, but the restrictions the government lay on us, that's federal and state, and then you've got your local governments, like your councils and all that, with their restriction, it makes it hard on Bummer to do anything.
Yes, no, there seems to be, like, barriers, fences put up, fencing us in wherever you go.
They must think we're cattle.
I think you're right, too. I think you're right, Unc. All right. Well, look, yeah, I hope you enjoy the conference, and it's good to meet you. Thanks for joining us here, having a bit of a yarn, eh? Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you too, mate.
We'll see you around, eh? I'm not sure. Yeah? Stormy Diamond, daughter for this one. We're going to take a break for a song. We're going to take a break for a song and come back. I've got to talk to Uncle here about his young daughter from Oakvale. Was involved in a project with us. Yeah, so back soon. All right, welcome back to Let's Talk. It's quite a bit of ambience and atmosphere here. Broadcasting live out of the National Native Title Conference. They've broken for their tea and coffee. But look, I've got Francis Kelly, all the way from Yundamu, Central Australia, joining me. Francis is also the chairperson for the Central Land Council. Central Land Council out there around Alice Springs, Central Australia. Francis, thanks for joining us. How are you?
All right. How are you, Jim?
All very well, brother. Now tell me, your mob, your country.
Well, my mob is from Walbury country, northwest of Alice Springs, 300 km, called Walbury people. And we're dealing on this radio before, in those early days.
Now, you've been around in radio longer than me, I think. But tell us about the early days there. Yundamu, Ernabella Mob, them two communities, they saw the importance of putting radio together before you even had license, permit, stuff like that. Tell us about that, and because it was pirate radio, really. You had no permit, no license. It was illegal.
Yeah, it's old people have been taught about it, because all these things are coming to early by through governments, you know. What else we could do? Because we said, well, we like to get information for ourselves to talk about among ourselves through the radios, reminding each other. This was in Yundamu in 1983, 84 and all that. We had a pirate telecast in Yundamu. We made it as a radio or receiver out of a copper. And that copper receiver is still there, and he's still working today. From 30 years, he's still going.
And when you say copper, is that copper antenna, piping, is that for antenna or what?
Yeah, it's a piping up in up antenna, and we made that. We made that. We went to a place called Tennant Creek. We asked a bloke down there because he was caught on our technology, and he gave us that one. You try this one out, and it'll work about 10 k's around receiving, not the television.
And that was purely to to inform community, people in the communities, about what was happening with the mob.
Yeah, it was really good because our people are happy to see themselves, but first of all, they were shy on the camera. And as soon as I see the picture on the telly, and they said, oh, I have to do one too. Mostly those old people in that area at Yundamu. And everybody, you know, becoming, and we had a donation from old people. When old people are sitting in a shop there, and people used to chuck $20 and all that to give a donation to run that business.
Now, that was the TV stuff, but radio, did it happen around the same time too, or was it a little bit later down the track?
No, it was both on the same, yeah, because we finally the government caught up with, hey, you're doing the telecast, you know, without permission and all that, and permits and license, and said, well, if you give us license and all that, we're already doing it at the moment. We are on the way. We can't stop it. You have to give it to us. And the bloke at Eric Wilmot, and he gave us a black box called antenna and all that. Yeah.
Yes, Eric Wilmot was the author of that report from Out of the Silent Land. And the Silent Land was communities like yours that had no communication and no television, no radio. So you mob took it upon yourself to do it yourself without no permit, no license.
Yeah, we did it ourselves, and the government recognised it then. After all, hey, communities missing out on this, we have to give something else to do now. So we done the radio and television, we done on filming, and later on, Telstra came in with mobile phone and with telephones, you know?
Yep. So we move forward 30, 35 years or so. We move forward 32 years. It's 2015. We see a national network of the radio, of Aboriginal media. We see the Aboriginal television station, NITV. You're mobbing at Yundamu and them remote communities. You're still making television program?
Oh, we are doing it because we're doing it, first of all, you know, we had it in our communities, like just ourselves, and other things came, like Imparcha came in, and we went to Queensland to talk about Indigenous television, that's in ITV. I was on that board, you know, running that business with the mother mob, and actually in ITV said, look, we like to get all our sponsors and from, sending all those tapes into NRDP to show it. But first of all, I made a film called Connison Massacre in that time to show the people. The Connison Massacre was really good. People liked it, so stories on that, you know, everybody got notified because it's been missing out and never been talking about Connison Massacre in those massacre days.
So that's the importance of having our own community-controlled television and radio to be able to tell these stories that don't get told.
Yeah, it was good, but not only that, the Connison Massacre, we made a bush mechanic too on that line and Aboriginal rules. And we're going to make a film about a lady called Olive Pink was in our country in early days.
So you're working on one now, project now for television?
We are working on it now. We just, you know, we need a funding for that area. And first of all, we want to get an archive in our community to establish it and to run on affair.
How is what's the effect of the income management, the intervention, what was known as the intervention? What's the impact of that in community like yours?
Well, I think it's an intervention made a little bit of mistake without understanding the community out there, you know, what they need. They just done it in their own control, what we need. We like to have people in the ground. We should ask independent, look, this is what we want, you keep us, not them, of what they think.
What's your thoughts on the education and getting our kids to school? Because we always hear Minister Scullion and people, white fella, always saying, are they black fella not going to send their kids to school? You know, we've got to stop their entitlements if they don't go to school and stuff. What do you think is the problem with going to school? Is it the fact that the lessons in the classrooms aren't relevant? Is it the fact that there's there's no incentive for a fellow to go to school because he's got no job he can go to. What do you think is the issue where there is the absence of engagement with schools? What do you think?
Well, put it this way, because, you know, some of those people hasn't got, you know, workmanship, like working and doing, but all those works, it's all about when people from other area come to work in our community. What's the difference to our people working in there, making self-determination and all that, you know? It's never been changed. But government telling us to do this and that, but government don't listen to us.
Yeah. And then language. Language is an issue because you mob. What, English, your second, third, fourth language?
Well, our language is best because we want to get a language program going in our communities, like, you know, education our kids in language. Another thing, it's about, you know, taking kids to school. But most important, in my time, people used to talk language in the school, you know, doing the writings and reading. But in the government, when I was going to school, there was no language in the school. You can't speak. You only need the English.
And so now today, is that still the same, or have you got classes happening in language?
Well, today, you know, language authority might talk about this, and we like to have language in our school, but it's, you know, the government's stopping this and that from, you know, the way we want to do it, you know. Our language and our countries are similar to each other.
Well, then you talk about too many white fellas sort of in them jobs and taking over. It seems to be happening in the media as well, where we got a lot of white fella in there controlling the media and making decision about what programs or what should be done. Is that an issue for you?
Well, in our media, we're doing our own program in our language to do that, you know. There's no white people come there, they work under our umbrella to do the job for us, you know, and plus we got a committee in that media of controlling it for finance and everything, you know.
And the programming, people involved in programming and being working on a radio and that, you've got enough people in community that they're interested, they like to be involved in either making a movie or being in a radio program?
Well, that's a lot of job there for our own people, like one bloke already working in an archive, doing the programs and getting all those stuff from the Canberra to bring it back and leave it, because some of those people who's been taking film in our early days never return it back to the community to recognise it. And they want the people in there, they want to see their, you know, countrymen in their photos or grandfather or grandmother.
And with the Native Title Conference here, how important is it for you to be involved in discussion at these sorts of gatherings?
Well, at this conference I'm recognising it because this is my first time in Port Douglas for a conference. You know, I've never been to a conference in my life yet, but this is the one I'm hearing about. I think it's, in my opinion, for my personal thinking is, you know, it's just only the government talk this and that, but in our language we call them folk tongues, means walga.
Yeah. Not really meaning what they talk sort of thing.
Well, they talk it round and round. It's like dog chasing his own tail. Run, run, yeah. And not talking straight to each other, you know? Yeah.
All right, Francis. My brother, it's good to catch up with you. I really appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Yeah, good to see you, brother.
And we'll see you again, eh?
Yeah. See you in Sydney.
Yeah, Brisbane.
Brisbane now.
Yeah. Brisbane now. Used
that's
to be
why
Sydney. All right. Thank you, Francis. That was Francis Kelly, man from Yundamu. He's one of the old pioneers of radio and television in First Nations communities. Like you heard him say, they was doing it, they was pirate radio mob out there and TV. They had no license, no permit, but they did it. And still around today. And now Francis is chairman of the Central Land Council based in Alice Springs. It's time for me to go. We're approaching news time. Big 2-hour program today. Live broadcast out of Port Douglas, the National Native Title Conference being held up here over the next couple of days. So you make sure you join us tomorrow. We'll be back here, same time, same place, 9 o'clock on your local First Nation station. You all have a great day.